That's right. The U.S. has sort of a treaty phobia approach that was particularly noticeable under the Trump administration, but is still part and parcel of the U.S. international approach. It's very busy right now trying to build international coalitions against Russia, but at the same time, it refuses to join most of its allies in joining important treaties like the Convention on Cluster Munitions and the Mine Ban Treaty that comprehensively bans anti-personnel mines. These are life-saving conventions. These are conventions that are in keeping with the desire to protect civilians, both during conflict and for years afterwards.
We're going to have to leave it there. Steve Goose of Human Rights Watch, we thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Clean Energy Fund under fire from business interests. Oregon City schools say yes to Narcan. And in international news, Afghanistan withers under U.S. sanctions. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 17, 2022. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Linda Woodley's nonprofit, Diversifying Energy, lost an $11.5 million grant from Portland's Clean Energy Fund when the Oregonian revealed her history of defrauding energy companies and tax evasion. Now she's suing the fund in federal court for defamation. Linda Woodley was originally contracted to provide energy-efficient cooling systems to low-income households. Her attorneys are seeking $600,000 in economic damages, claiming Woodley was not given opportunity to respond to the allegations. Portland's Clean Energy Fund was created in 2018 as a unique climate justice program led by communities of color and managed by the City of Portland. Among other projects, it funds solar panels for multifamily homes, workforce training programs in the clean energy sector, and food gardens in lower-income neighborhoods. It is largely funded by a 1% city tax on large retailers, which raised far more money than expected, almost $90 million last year. That unexpected budget windfall has the Portland Business Alliance calling on the city to freeze funding for the Young program. Business Alliance CEO Andrew Hohen issued a statement urging Portland to halt the program's spending and redirect funds towards homeless shelters and a fire training program. Clean Energy Fund program manager Sam Barrasso called Hohen's letter to the city, quote, reckless and disingenuous. The Portland Business Alliance has often crossed paths with progressive policies. The private business lobby receives public funds, including $25 million that the lobby spent on an armed security force, Portland Clean and Safe. The lobby protests the 1% tax on large business transactions, despite requiring annual fees from downtown businesses to maintain Clean and Safe of up to $200,000. State Representative and Environmental Justice Advocate Con Pham weighed in on the debate. This is a community initiative that does need to grow and scale to meet the climate reality we're facing, Pham said. The people of Portland are hoping for more action and more funding, not less. The Oregon City School Board voted Tuesday to stock public schools with naloxone, a life-saving drug for opioid overdoses, better known by its brand name, Narcan. The measure passed with overwhelming public support. Oregon City has seen children die from fentanyl overdoses, and two teens in Portland overdosed on the drug days before the school board vote. The measure included training for teachers, staff, and anyone who wishes to be certified in Narcan administration. The medicine has negligible side effects if accidentally administered, and it can be easily inhaled as a nasal spray. Fentanyl overdoses rose during the pandemic to become the top killer of Americans age 18 to 45, taking 79,000 lives between 2020 and 21. Statistics are in from the U.S. Census estimating that 37% of Oregonians are at risk of foreclosure or eviction in the next 2 months. Among senior citizens, that rate rises to almost 40%. The cost of living has increased far faster than either wages or Social Security. According to the federal standard measuring livable rent prices as no more than 30% of a person's income, a senior citizen relying solely on Social Security can afford to spend about $252 per month on rent. At the core of the problem are rising cost of living in Oregon and the country's disintegrating social safety net. Housing advocates say that even the state's new $400 million housing relief bill will be insufficient to fill the gap. A University of Portland study shows that only 16% of renters who filed for safe harbor under protection were actually protected from eviction. Elderly people on fixed incomes also suffer from additional setbacks, including increased physical strain from moving and higher medical bills. Academic studies show that homeless seniors are a growing demographic and that by 2030, current numbers could triple. Texas threw out 13% of all mail-in ballots in the March 1st primary, an unprecedented rate of vote rejection. That's more than six times higher than what experts consider a concerning rate in an election. Texas's stringent new voting rules are part of a national campaign by the Republican Party to reshape elections in favor of a conservative minority. Although voter fraud is exceptionally rare, Republican politicians have passed voter ID laws aimed to disproportionately target people of color. Historians have likened the recent bout of voter restrictions to Jim Crow-era legislation. Indeed, Democratic-held areas such as Houston saw the highest number of discarded ballots, where almost a fifth of votes were invalidated. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who signed the voting restrictions into law, has so far been silent about the high rejection levels. A handful of senators from both parties are pushing the Building Civic Bridges Act, which is meant to promote local efforts to foster trust through political and demographic boundaries. A failure to do so, they say, could exacerbate the threat to American democracy. For the full story, here's Eric Tegedoff.
A measure in Congress aims to help heal the divides in the United States civil society. Washington State Representative Derek Kilmer of Gig Harbor has introduced the Building Civic Bridges Act alongside eight other Democrats and nine Republicans. In terms of its need, he cites recent polling that shows Americans are worried about the country's divisions. That includes more than three-quarters who believe there is a threat to democracy and majority rule in this country. Kilmer says the goal of the measure is to create more common ground in local communities.
I think a healthy, religiously, racially, ethnically diverse democracy relies on the ability of everyday citizens to live and work and serve and pray alongside people who think differently than they do. And we have struggled, I think, increasingly in our country to do that.
Kilmer says local events in Tacoma inspired this legislation, including a series of attacks on faith institutions and conflicts at a YMCA. He says in each case, after some mediation to help heal divides, local leaders in the community asked him if federal funding was available to do more bridge building. Kilmer also says a recent report noting that the U.S. funds efforts at social cohesion and democracy abroad inspired him. He realized this would make sense here as well, so he and the other co-sponsors came up with a model to do this at home.
One, doing grant making to these hyper-local efforts, the local YMCA, the Interfaith Alliance, that's trying to do this important work of trying to build some understanding across lines of difference. Two, to train AmeriCorps participants in the skills of bridge building. And three, to support colleges and universities that do work in this space.
Kilmer says there could be progress moving this bill forward as soon as this week. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee voted yesterday to advance the nomination of incumbent Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. That's after West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin broke ranks with his party to refuse Biden's first nominee, Sarah Bloom Raskin. Republicans in Manchin opposed Raskin because of her stance against climate change and against distributing COVID relief funds to fossil fuel companies. Raskin withdrew her nomination Tuesday. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin has often broken ranks with Democrats, killing bills for paid family leave and abolishing the filibuster, in addition to supporting Trump's border wall and attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Manchin has also received more funding from the oil and gas industry than any other senator this year, with over $1.6 million in donations. Manchin's son runs Enner Systems, a coal brokerage the senator founded in 1988. Manchin received over $5 million in stock dividends from the company since 2011, including more than $500,000 in 2020. Raskin addressed Manchin and Republican senators' stance against climate directly in her resignation letter. "Their point of contention was my frank public discussion of climate change and the economic cost associated with it." Raskin says it is not a novel or radical position to add climate change to the risks that the Fed should consider. President Zelensky of Ukraine implored U.S. Congress to increase lethal aid. While the U.S. has provided weapons and aid to his country, deeper involvement in the war with Russia has been contentious. With more on this story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Russia has attacked not just us, not just our land, not just our cities. It went on a brutal offensive against our values.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke to Americans Wednesday with a graphic portrait of his country's suffering during the Russian invasion. Zelensky also called for a no-fly zone over Ukraine, more weapons, and tougher economic sanctions. President Joe Biden announced an additional $800 million in military aid to Ukraine for weapons including drones, grenade launchers, and ammunition. He also promised more resources in the coming days.
Make Putin pay the price, weaken his position.
The White House maintains it will not support a no-fly zone. The Federal Reserve increased the federal funds rate a quarter point Wednesday. The benchmark rate is used by banks to charge on loans and set borrowing costs on credit cards, vehicles, and mortgages. Acting Federal Reserve Board Chair Jerome Powell said he expects the labor market to remain strong, but consumers won't get a breather from inflation anytime soon.
That said, inflation is likely to take longer to return to our price stability goal than previously expected.
Senate Finance Committee members Wednesday held a hearing on prescription drug pricing as inflation drives up prices. Stephanie Stern with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society testified.
It's very common for people with MS, like my mom, to have to rely on some kind of financial assistance to afford their costs. Our studies show around 70% of people rely on financial assistance just so they can pay their out-of-pocket.
According to a new report from the financial resource company Value Penguin, since 2010, consumer spending on prescription and non-prescription drugs has increased every year, and the average household pays around $4,000 for prescription medications. The U.S. Department of Education says historically black colleges and universities that recently received bomb threats are eligible for federal grants to boost campus security. Vice President Kamala Harris said the Biden administration is also releasing a resource guide
for colleges and universities with detailed information on detecting, preventing, and recovering from threats and acts of violence.
The U.S. Department of Justice has reached a more than $127 million settlement with the families of most of those killed or wounded in a 2018 Florida high school massacre over the FBI's failure to stop the gunman, even though it received information he intended to attack a month before the shooting. The settlement does not amount to an admission of fault by the United States, according to the Justice Department. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Afghanistan has largely dropped from headlines since the U.S. withdrawal last summer, but the country continues to suffer from American policies. Economic sanctions put in place by the Biden administration are hampering the country's recovery from a 42-year war, which began shortly before the Soviet invasion and continued through the American occupation. One of the principal fiscal decisions harming average Afghanis is an executive order signed by President Biden last month, taking half of Afghan government funds held in trust and distributing them among families of 9/11 victims. The seizure of $3.5 billion belonging to the Afghan government effectively punishes the people of the country for terrorist attacks carried out by non-Afghans over 20 years ago. Afghanistan suffers from severe shortages of food and fuel, which has led to a surge in child starvation. Although statistics from the war-torn country are hard to come by, UNICEF notes that admissions to children's hospitals for malnutrition have doubled since August, and one in every five children admitted to critical care is dying. Afghanistan's public health care system is funded by the Taliban government. If the remaining $3.5 billion held in trust in the U.S. were returned to Afghanistan, it would belong to the Taliban to distribute. UN Refugee Agency Chief Filippo Grandi pleaded from Kabul yesterday that the international community support more than 95% of Afghanis experiencing food shortages. More than 24 million in the country rely on humanitarian support, but UN programs in the country are critically underfunded. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Clean Water Act, followed by Noise Filter. At 6, it's Rose City Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is in the high and mid-40s. Cool and cloudy weather continues tomorrow with a high around 57. Today is St. Patrick's Day. The Catholic feast originally commemorates the death of St. Patrick, a Romano-British priest who originally brought Christianity to Ireland. Today, the holiday is more generally a commemoration of Irish heritage and culture. The quote of the day is from James Joyce. O Ireland, my first and only love, where Christ and Caesar are hand in glove. California environmental voters have given the Golden State a D rating on its environmental scorecard. Chief among its environmental shortfalls is a statewide failure to address climate change. Advocates say this indicates the environmental hypocrisy in one of America's most liberal states. With more on this story is Suzanne Potter.
California only got a D grade on this year's environmental scorecard, a report card put out each year since 1973 by the nonprofit California Environmental Voters. The low score mostly comes from inaction on the many climate bills that stalled in the state Senate, even though Democrats have a supermajority. Mary Kreisman with California Environmental Voters says many Democratic lawmakers talk a good game, but then vote to delay climate action.
We actually have the solutions and the technology, and all of those things are actually job creators too, and will advance our economy. What we don't have is the political will to do it at the rate and scale that science tells us we have to.
Opponents of climate action bills often cite the costs to business. But the report blames inaction on the influence of fossil fuel companies, finding that 52% of Democrats and 96% of Republicans accepted campaign cash from oil interests. The scorecard says Governor Gavin Newsom made pro-climate decisions 82% of the time. Overall, state Democrats earned a score of 80%, while Republicans got a score of 15%. Assemblyman Steve Bennett says it's been tough to get colleagues to devote sufficient resources to decarbonize buildings and transportation, switch to renewables, or modernize our grid and energy storage.
Politicians don't get popular by asking people to make sacrifices today to solve a problem that's going to come in 15 or 20 years down the road. And that's why we've been so slow in taking action on climate change.
Former Assemblyman David Chu, now city attorney for San Francisco, says there is hope if Californians work together.
There is enough wind off of our coast of California to power the entire grid with clean power while creating great jobs for tens of thousands of workers. But there is so much work we need to continue to do to advance clean energy solutions.
You can look up your representative's score and read the entire report at envirovoters.org/scorecard. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Considering the current rate of global warming, the National Academy of Sciences predicts that American West, including Oregon, will enter a state of perpetual drought. That is, if it isn't there already. The paper's authors state definitively that Oregon's climate has already gone past the point of no return. More than a third of the state has been in a severe drought or worse for the entire past two decades, including three-quarters of the state today. Diminishing snowpack on Oregon's mountains will also deplete the rivers and streams on which central and eastern Oregon depend. In Klamath County, the Oregon Water Resources Department received 34 new reports of depleted wells so far this year, on top of the 200 reported during last year's record hot summer, during which 600 people died from overheating. Scientists say that decline indicates a 10-foot drop in non-renewable groundwater levels. The revelation led Governor Kate Brown to issue the state's earliest ever drought emergency declaration of the year. Reservoirs around the state are also up to 30% lower than they were this time last year. The current western super drought brings the driest conditions in the region in 1,200 years, and it may trigger another unprecedented fire season as early as May. Water conservation is changing the way that Oregonians can safely live and consume. Water-intensive activities such as ranching and agriculture may become untenable in much of eastern and southern Oregon. Grain farmers in Wisconsin have dealt with setbacks in recent years from climate change and the pandemic. A new initiative known as GRIT is helping farmers build environmentally and economically resilient operations. Jonah Chester has more.
A new program is seeking to help Wisconsin's grain farmers build more environmentally and economically resilient operations. The Midwest Grain Resource and Immersive Training, or GRIT, program aims to bolster the Midwest's grain shed by increasing the number and diversity of small and mid-sized farms across the region growing food-grade grains. Christine Johnson is with the Wisconsin-based Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, which oversees the program. She says strengthening farmers' resiliency benefits local consumers down the supply chain.
So having that regional food system established and strong will just help both the farmer and our communities alike going forward.
According to the U.S. Agricultural Census, which is conducted every 5 years, Wisconsin gained small and large farms from 2012 to 2017, but lost more than 4,200 mid-sized farms. The GRIT program includes a year of paid training and education programs for current and aspiring grain farmers. Applications for the program are open through the end of March. At least a third of the program's open spots will be reserved for farmers who are women. Johnson, who's a farmer herself, says the initiative includes programming specifically to support gender-specific barriers for female farm operators and entrepreneurs.
We're also holding space for other communities, such as Black and Indigenous farmers, and really making a point to decrease barriers within our region for all farmers that want to achieve success.
Johnson says that USDA census data and state grain farmer training surveys suggest that only 15 to 20% of grain farmers in the Midwest identify as female. Per the 2017 Ag Census, about 35% of all farm operators in the state were women, up 16% from 2012. For the Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Jonah Chester.
Yesterday, the White House reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act. Tribal leaders are celebrating the move, particularly Biden's statement that tribal courts have jurisdiction in cases of abuse in Indian country. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native women's advocates, tribal leaders, Native American members of the Biden administration, and members of Congress were among those at the White House Wednesday celebrating the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. The reauthorization of VAWA includes tribal provisions to increase resources, strengthen sovereignty and safety across Indian country. President Biden, in his remarks at the event, mentioned tribes twice when talking about jurisdiction issues.
Restoring jurisdiction of tribal courts. Over non-Native domestic violence offenders who abuse women in Indian country.
Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. was at the VAWA event.
Well, it's a great day for the country because in the national interest of the United States to have VAWA reauthorized. But it's certainly important to Indian country because of the provisions VAWA already contained in the new provision.
Hoskin says what the new provisions will do is allow tribes to have fewer restraints, which he says has kept tribes from protecting the most vulnerable and will help hold more non-Indian offenders accountable for breaking the law.
Tribes across the country have been constrained in terms of addressing sex trafficking and other types of violence that unfortunately more often than not occur with women as their victims, assaults and and those sorts of offenses were just beyond the reach of tribes, but no more, because VAWA allows us to do what we need to do.
The reauthorization restores tribal jurisdiction over non-Indians for certain crimes involving children, sexual violence, stalking, sex trafficking, obstruction of justice, and assaults against law enforcement and corrections personnel. South Dakota officials are determining what to do with a golf course they're acquiring near a state park. A tribal research group wants the land converted to a natural area, as Richard Tubles reports.
The Spring Creek Golf Course sits at the southern border of Good Earth State Park, a few miles southeast of Sioux Falls in Lincoln County. A foundation acquired the land and will transfer it to the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks by 2025. The land may be incorporated into Good Earth, which already spans 1,200 acres and includes the Blood Run National Historic Landmark. It was inhabited by Native Americans between 1300 and 1700 AD. The Omaha Tribal Historical Research Project is proposing the golf course be converted back to its natural condition. The state says there are several options under consideration. Al Nedved is the Deputy State Parks Director.
We developed great relationships with the Omaha tribes and the other tribes. And yes, they were involved in our very first meeting on this Spring Creek issue. And we would look forward to further discussions with them.
The Omaha Tribal Historical Research Project says existing development on the land may have inadvertently violated the federal 1990 Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Nedved says the state wants to know what resources may still exist there.
We realize the importance of having a good, solid understanding of what's present on the site, and a good understanding of what some of the potential options as a state park operation might look like there. And
according to Friends of Blood Run, prior to development, there were 270 visible burial mounds on the site that were reduced to 70 due to construction and farming. I'm Richard Tubles.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Following a fatal attack in a maternity hospital, the Russian military bombed a theater in the city of Mariupol, where 1,300 civilians have sheltered. So far, 130 have emerged from the wreckage, although the government of Ukraine lacks the capacity for a full rescue operation. Little is known about the extent of deaths or injuries in the theater. Before it was bombed, satellite images confirmed that the word children was written on the side of the building in letters large enough to be visible from the sky. The city of Mariupol has endured some of the worst damage of the war. Its city council estimated yesterday that 80% of its housing structures are destroyed, 30% irreparably. Attempts to evacuate Mariupol have failed under Russian attacks, and more than 350,000 residents remain sheltered across the city. Russia shells the city continuously and launches an average of 50 to 200 airstrikes per day. A UN report says that over 1,600 civilian deaths since last year's coup in Myanmar might constitute crimes against humanity. The military dictatorship overthrew the country's fragile democracy in February 2021, violently cracking down on protests with live ammunition. In addition to the killings, the military junta has been accused of using rape, torture, forced drug injections, and starvation against protesters. Over 12,500 people have been detained, and 14 million people urgently need humanitarian assistance. Myanmar has been in a state of perpetual civil war since the end of the British colonial period in 1948. The country was ruled by a civilian government led by Aung San Suu Kyi from 2011 to 2021 when the coup occurred and Suu Kyi was arrested. Even during the country's flirtation with democracy, a state-sponsored genocide against Myanmar's Muslim Rohingya minority rose to prominence as one of the world's most pressing humanitarian catastrophes. The military council currently governing the state has received no international recognition, but it receives international support from China, India, and Russia. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 17, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer is myself, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Ramlagan, Eric Tagadoff, Suzanne Potter, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandwise. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for a report on the shortfalls of the Clean Water Act.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's been 50 years since the landmark environmental law, the Clean Water Act, was passed in 1972. It was an ambitious piece of legislation, and it made a real difference in some of the most polluted rivers and waterways in the U.S. But a new report from the Environmental Integrity Project shows that half a century later, the promises of the Clean Water Act have only been half kept. Their research ranked Oregon as number two in the U.S. for the most miles of rivers and waterways that aren't safe for swimming and other kinds of recreation. I spoke with Eric Schaefer, one of the report's co-authors, to learn more about their findings. So yeah, thanks for taking the time to speak with me today. The Environmental Integrity Project has just released this report that shows that about half of the rivers, lakes, and reservoirs in the United States are still not safe for swimming, fishing, and recreation, which is, of course, contrary to what the Clean Water Act of 1972 would have provided. And that's definitely a big problem. To start out, for folks who may be unfamiliar, what did the Clean Water Act put into law back when it was first passed?
We were supposed to get fishable, swimmable,